It's a brand new day. Jane found this acupuncture book and we've been talking about the acupuncture needle of Zazen, for Zazen, that sharp, fine point inserted at just the right place to disperse the blockages to free flowing energy. But we haven't really talked about the acupuncture point, the place, the accurate place where the needle is placed. So according to this Five Spirits book, yeah, this author's talking about wu, emptiness. Really, we say in Buddhism wu, or in Japanese mu, right, is like no, or there isn't any, kind of an absence. A kind of space. So, even the acupuncture point is a kind of wu, or a kind of spacious absence. The Chinese word for the acupuncture point, the place where you put the shin, the needle, is shui, which refers to a cave, a hole, or hollow space. So the acupuncture point is viewed as a doorway, a nothingness, an opening in the material matrix of the body. The point's effectiveness lies in its emptiness, the space it opens for the spinning pivot of the acupuncture needle. Cool, huh? The place where you put the acupuncture needle is an opening in the material matrix of the body, a doorway or a nothingness. So we have some disease, we have some dis-ease, we feel like maybe there's some problem here after a few days of sitting, like another few days of sitting could be the problem or whatever. We make something where it's not just like the present moment's energy flow is just easeful. There's some dis-ease. So if we place the acupuncture needle of non-thinking at the right at the place where the blockage is, if we look closely, according to Lori Detchar, this author, that place of blockage is actually like a cave, like an open space. It's like a nothingness. And the spinning pivot of the acupuncture needle of non-thinking, it's spinning at approximately 48 million RPM. Non-thinking very, very still, very dynamic. Remember that this old, some old Chinese acupuncture text said the acupuncture needle is the pivot around which the universe turns. So the spinning pivot of the acupuncture needle is placed in the spacious emptiness that seems to be the blockage point. In other words, the blockage point is actually just spacious emptiness. The place where the energy is blocked is actually very spacious. And this acupuncture point of blockage is a doorway, an opening in the material matrix of the body. Often feels like maybe the place where we have to put this non-thinking needle is just the opposite. It's like the most solidified, stuck, solid, constricted, unspacious point in the whole body. But if we look very, very closely, it's a spacious, open point where the blockage is. And the needle, therefore, the needle of non-thinking can fit there very easily and nicely, since there's a lot of open space there. So, another image, another metaphor for this practice of the non-thinking Buddha that's not seeking to make a Buddha, the non-seeking, the non-thinking Buddha making, not seeking to make a Buddha, but continuously making a Buddha. Here's Dogen's extensive record, Dharma Hall Discourse 453, Book 6. Polishing a tile to make a mirror is our reward for accumulating merit and virtue. Polishing a mirror to make a tile certainly depends on the nourishment from wisdom. So, polishing a tile, as you may recall, is like Dogen's praises the virtues of polishing a tile, continuous practice, continuous polishing, and the mirror is right there at the time of polishing. It's not that the polishing the tile gradually makes a mirror. It's more that the polishing reveals the mirror that's right there. And without polishing, the mirror isn't revealed. But this work of polishing the tile is a reward for accumulating merit and virtue. I don't know how the Chinese goes, but I think I brought up maybe a few weeks ago this accumulation of merit and accumulation of wisdom. You know, these two sides that to make a Buddha, traditionally, Mahayana Buddhism, you have to fulfill the accumulation of merit, which is like conventional practices in the world, and you have to fulfill the accumulation of wisdom, that's realization of that nothing's actually happening. So it sounds like maybe Dogen's talking about these two different sides. Maybe it could be translated as polishing a tile to make a mirror creates or accumulates merit and virtue. Polishing a mirror to make a tile certainly depends on the nourishment from wisdom. Or maybe we could say, you know, the effort to polish the tile to make a mirror, this is accumulating merit. Sitting on the cushion in a particular room and a particular time and place. This is accumulation of merit. Just trying to not move and be settled and support each other in sesshin. This is accumulating merit. And then polishing a mirror to make a tile is like accumulation of wisdom. Be like this. This is like the inconceivable work. The mirror that's already, we can't even find the mirror because it has no location. So this inconceivable work, maybe in this case, of polishing the mirror that actually makes a tile. Polishing a mirror to make a tile is like the wisdom work. Or maybe Dogen's just playing. Polishing a tile to make a mirror creates the reward of accumulation of merit and virtue. Polishing a mirror to make a tile certainly nourishes wisdom. Polishing a mirror to make a mirror brings a laugh. How are my hands and a Buddha's hands similar? This is from, I think it's in Mumon Khan, a koan. This is a koan. I think the whole koan. How is my hand and a Buddha's hand similar? You can take that one up. Practicing zazen to make a Buddha is making a grass seat at the site of awakening. Or another translation is, practicing zazen to make a Buddha is taking our weeds and sitting at the site of awakening. Our mind weeds, like Suzuki Roshi talks about, taking all our stuff, including all our stuff and our efforts to polish a tile and return again and again to the present. All our mind weeds that pull us into the past and future. Taking all of that and sitting at the site of awakening. Why is it like this? After a pause, Dogen said, when one cart is struck, many carts go quickly. One night a flower blooms and the world is fragrant. Do you strike the cart or strike the ox? When one cart is struck, many carts go quickly. You could say when one person for one moment sits on a particular seat, the whole phenomenal world of carts, all realizes awakening. When one wholehearted practice is expressed, the whole world becomes like a practice site. I think that's a nice image. When one cart is struck, many carts go quickly or immediately. So if you think that the Zazen Shin fascicle is strange and difficult, I think Dogen's extensive record is even like, gives even less place to get a foothold. But I share that story because Dogen likes this polishing tile story. He brings it up in various places and exhales in different kinds of ways, expressing different things. Okay. Ready? Zazen Shin, acupuncture needle of Zazen. The point of Zazen is this. Nanyue went on in the original story. Are you studying seated meditation or are you studying seated Buddha? Are you studying Zazen or are you studying Zabutsu?
Did we do the jade?
Yeah. Throwing out a tile to take in a jade is like throwing out a humble way of throwing out a question and asking for a capping verse, a beautiful jade jewel to kind of like match the rough tile, which is apparently an old Chinese saying, and so Dogen in his creative thing is like, well, that's a saying about a tile, and it fits the case here, but it, you know, it happens to be throwing out a tile. The more you look into Dogen, you see that like almost every sentence he's writing is like, seems like it's carefully constructing or referring to a whole world of practice and ideas of Dharma, and maybe just it's a spontaneous inspiration too, but almost no sentence seems random. Although at first, when you first read it, it seems like the whole thing is completely random. It's like, well, he could be just saying anything, you know. But that's why I think going through slowly like this, and the more and more, I think it takes time with Dogen, you start to see how he's doing a lot of word play, playing with language, and he's in a kind of creative and somewhat humorous way, bringing in references to the things he's talking about. He's really like kind of a, I would say like a literary genius, as well as kind of philosophical genius, that he can put this all together in this way. It's so hard to appreciate it fully, I think, because it's so strange and so difficult and so profound. Thus, I would like to keep studying Dogen for the rest of my life. So Nanyue went on, are you studying sitting meditation or are you studying sitting Buddha? Investigating these words, we should distinguish the essential activity of the patriarchal ancestors. Without knowing what the full reality of studying seated meditation is, we do know here that it is studying seated Buddha. Who but a scion, which I think means like an ancestor, like
an heir.
Okay, yeah.
Descended from.
Who but an heir of true descent could say that studying seated meditation is studying seated Buddha? We should know indeed that the seated meditation of beginner's mind is the first seated meditation, and the first seated meditation is the first seated Buddha. So, studying, Dogen saying, studying Zazen is studying sitting Buddha. And who but a Zen ancestor could say such a thing? Now, he's changing the original question, right? Is, are you studying sitting meditation or are you studying sitting Buddha? And Dogen saying, studying sitting meditation is studying sitting Buddha. Nanyue said, if you're studying seated meditation, meditation is not sitting still. And the original actually says, is not sitting or lying down. So it's referring to like, it's not a particular posture. You know, we have these going back to Buddha's time, there's the four postures. Buddha makes a list of everything. The four postures are sitting, standing, lying down, and walking gets its own posture. And those are all like valid meditation postures. Even lying down, the Buddha entered parinirvana in lying down meditation.
Walking,
yeah. That's one of the four. And walk, that's what we do here, right? We do like sitting and walking. And we sometimes do standing, like service, we just stand. It's like a, so, there's probably other postures, but those are the four classic meditation postures.
Question. Mm-hmm. When we say studying, do we mean practicing, or do we mean talking about practicing?
I think Dogen often uses study as investigate, not so much like studying words about it, but investigating in our own experience, kind of like deeply checking out our own experience.
As we do it.
As we do it, yeah, as we do it, yeah. Since you ask, let's just check this out. I think it might be San. Which means to study. And it has that, you know, I think pretty much like the English word study, it can mean like universities in Japan are called like gakuin, so that it does actually mean like book study too. But Dogen uses it for investigating in our own experience. So if you're studying sitting meditation, meditation is not sitting still or lying down. It's not a matter of the posture. So we're saying zazen is not a matter of just za. It's not a matter of a particular posture. The point of what he says here is that seated meditation is seated meditation and is not sitting still. From the time the fact that it is not sitting still has been singly transmitted to us, our unlimited sitting still is our own self. So zazen is not limited to some particular posture. But, and from the time that understanding has been singly transmitted to us, our unlimited sitting still is our own self. So zazen's not just sitting still, and when we understand that, our unlimited sitting still is our own self. So it's just, you know, constantly not falling into either side. So zazen's not a matter of just sitting still then. Okay, it's not a matter of some particular posture. When we understand that, then our sitting in a particular posture is our own true self. Like, form is actually just emptiness. But emptiness is form. These two sides. You could hear it like that. Does that make sense? Like, it's not limited to this, it's way beyond this, but this way beyond this includes this unlimited expressions of form, like sitting still, and that's who we really are, a moment-to-moment expression of a particular form. That's how I would understand that sentence. Yeah.
Can form comprehend emptiness, or does it have to experience it some other way?
Can form comprehend emptiness? Well, in a way, we'd say like, to the extent that, to some degree, I would say, because like consciousness is in the world of form. A form here, we mean like all five skandhas is, you know, think of it, the conventional world of appearance. And one of the conventional appearances in this world is consciousness, and consciousness is actually emptiness, but as it appears as consciousness, it can comprehend emptiness to some extent, right? Like we can have a conceptual understanding of emptiness, that kind of comprehension, but for the full comprehension of emptiness, we'd say just emptiness understands emptiness. Comprehends emptiness completely, yeah. We could also call that like Buddha nature is emptiness united with awareness, or it's aware emptiness, or empty awareness. And therefore, since it's aware, it can directly know, but without touching emptiness. This would be the poem later in the fascicle. Knowing without touching things is the mind of Zazen. You can actually, we could say comprehending without like touching the object of comprehension. Still comprehending. But we'll get to that. Why should we inquire about close or distant familial lines? How could we discuss delusion and awakening? Who would seek wisdom and eradication? So the footnote here, because that's kind of strange. Footnote says, close and distant familial lines here probably refers to the logical relationship between our human sitting and the Buddha's sitting.
Which is close and which is distant.
Yeah. Close or distant familial lines. Maybe, because we don't, you know, if this, we're just stretching this, but if that's what it's referring to, it's a little bit of a stretch, but maybe we could say close is like the one that we know closely right here. I mean, it's a good question, right? Is it the one we know right here and Buddha's like kind of distant to our comprehension? Or is Buddha the one that's really close and the one we think about is distant? Yes, that's a good question. Footnote does not clarify. Well, maybe we'll see what another translation says about this close and distant. Why should we question whether we are intimate or non-intimate with the life vein? Well, that's a very different feeling. Me myaku.
Like the blood vein?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So it's or myo myaku. It's meaning like yeah the blood vein of the Zen ancestors. I think is actually what it's referring to, and intimate is actually the character. Close. I guess you could say close or distant, intimate or not intimate. Why should we question whether we are intimate or not intimate with the life vein? That's a whole different feeling, which is actually, I think, kind of nicer and more straightforward. How can we discuss delusion and realization? Who would seek after the virtue of wisdom and cutting off attachments? I think this is all kind of like, once we realize that after we have singularly transmitted the truth that Zazen is Zazen, in parentheses, neither sitting nor lying down, infinite sitting and lying down are ourself. After we actually have singularly transmitted the truth that Zazen is Zazen, neither sitting nor lying down, we could say free from any particular posture, then infinite particular postures are our true self. And once we realize that, then why should we question whether we're intimate or not with the life vein of the Buddhas? How could we discuss delusion and realization? This is not an issue anymore, right? Who would seek after the virtue of wisdom and cutting off attachments?
That's Shohaku,
yeah. Yeah, that's a nice one, huh? This is Kaz Tanahashi. This teaching has been transmitted person to person. Thus, boundless sitting and lying down are the self beyond self. When you reflect on your life activities, are they intimate with Zazen or remote from it? Is there enlightenment or is there delusion in Zazen? Is there one whose wisdom penetrates Zazen? That's a whole other twist too, huh? When you reflect on your life activities, maybe just referring to the postures of your life, right? Sitting and lying down, for example, are they intimate with Zazen or remote from it?
That would seem like all of life.
Or maybe life activities is translation of life vein. Because it actually has the character for life, but I don't know, but this is how it is translating Dogen, huh? Then Nanyue said, if you're studying seated Buddha, Buddha is no fixed mark. So the original story now is, remember, Nanyue, after he sets up the whole thing about, like, what are you doing? Are you striking the cart or ox here? Now, if you're studying and wanting to practice true Zazen, do you want to practice sitting Zen or do you want to practice sitting Buddha? If you're studying sitting Buddha, Buddha is no fixed mark or characteristic, like lakshana in Sanskrit. Buddha doesn't have the characteristic of sitting or lying down. I think he's particularly referring to these marks or characteristics that we can see, like sitting and lying down, but also probably referring to the Diamond Sutra, where the Buddha talks about these marks. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, what do you think, Sibuti? Can the Tathagata, can the Buddha be seen by the possession of his marks or characteristics or lakshana? And kind of probably referring to the Buddha has these 32 marks or characteristics in the early sutras, like long earlobes and swastika marks on his feet and webbed fingers and a protuberance on the top of his head and a tiny hair curl on the forehead. I won't list them all. If you put together all these marks and you try to like draw a picture of the Buddha like this, it would be a little bit strange. Like, I think something like his, you know, his fingers reach all the way down to the ground, his tongue can touch the tip of his nose. The 32 marks of the Buddha. So you know it's the Buddha. Yeah. And I think this is actually a pre-Buddhist teaching in India that, like, the great beings have these marks. There's a whole a sutra, again, in the Pali Canon about somebody's doubting that he's really a Buddha. And he's, like, checking out all his marks, but some of them are under his robe, so he can't see them all. And I think he reports back to somebody else, I saw he had, like, 28 of the marks, but I couldn't see them all. I forget how that one goes. So this is the Diamond Sutra, the Prajna Paramita Diamond Sutra. The Buddha says, what do you think, Sabuti? Can the Tathagata be seen by the possession of his marks? Sabuti replied, no indeed, O Lord. And why? What has been taught by the Tathagata as the possession of marks, that is truly a no possession of no marks. The Lord said, wherever there's possession of marks, there is fraud. Wherever there's no possession of no marks, there's no fraud. Hence the Tathagata is to be seen from no marks as marks. Or the true marks of the Tathagata, the true mark, there's only one mark, and that's no marks. Yeah. No characteristics that by which we can grasp the Tathagata. Yes.
Is this kind of writing designed to get us to the place where non-thinking takes place?
Please. Yeah. Are you thinking?
No.
Very good. I think it is designed to undermine our usual way of thinking and grasping our thoughts. And he's kind of like, he makes us struggle with some other kinds of thinking, and at some point we may just like give up in laughter, and then maybe it's done its work. But then Dogen says, but you must thoroughly investigate this, so we can't just say, oh, this is just a bunch of nonsense. It's like we get really into it and then see how beneath the words there's non-thinking. Oh, yeah, I think all these Dharma teachings are pointing in various different conceptual ways to non-thinking. Hence the Tathagata is to be seen from no marks as marks. So the Bodhi leaf from India. And the Heart Sutra says, all dharmas are marked by emptiness, and it's the same word, lakshana. So it's very similar to the Diamond Sutra here. All dharmas have a mark. All dharmas is all phenomena. All phenomena have this particular mark of no mark, which is called emptiness. So it's kind of playing with that. Why not just say all dharmas have no mark? Instead, just the way that it is played out is all dharmas have the mark of emptiness, or have the mark of no mark. So probably thinking of the Diamond Sutra here, Nanyue says, if you're studying sitting Buddha, Buddha is no fixed mark. And it's a little different than the Diamond Sutra says that the Tathagata has no marks, and that's his mark. It's even more direct to say Buddha is no fixed mark. It's not like Buddha is this person, this kind of person with characteristics that has no characteristics. It's more that Buddha, what Buddha is just no fixed marks.
Sort of like the term, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him.
Yeah.
Has something to do with, you know, that the fact that Buddha isn't outside of anybody, or...
Yeah.
You know, it's all here already in the moment.
Yeah. And we're going to get to that. There's some killing going on soon in the story here. The killing. The slaughter will soon begin. Buddha is no fixed mark. And also, there's... you can keep in mind here, maybe... I don't know if Nanyue was playing with this, or Dogen likes to play with this, but the word fixed in Chinese here is the character that's used to translate samadhi. For some reason, all the characters, sometimes we say zamai, right? Gigiu, zamai. That's just the transliteration of the sound. Zamai. But what sometimes is, if you're just translating it directly and with one character, it's this Tei, I think. No, Joe, you pronounce it Joe. And it's it means like fixed or very stable and still. So that's the connotation of samadhi, is like the kind of fixed, still state of body and mind. That's the character they chose for samadhi. So no fixed mark. You could read it as no samadhi mark. Yeah, if you're studying sitting Buddha, Buddha is no mark of samadhi, or Buddha has no marks. Buddhist samadhi has no marks, maybe. And samadhi is like meditation, right? So it's related. So you can say, if you're studying sitting Buddha, Buddha's meditation, Buddha's zazen has no fixed mark. So that's another little angle on it too. Dogen says, such is the way to say what is to be said. Imo, such is the way to say what is to be said. The reason the seated Buddha is one or two Buddhas is that he adorns himself with no fixed mark. Sitting Buddha is one or two Buddhas, so kind of specific. One or two is kind of seems to be referring to, you know, not just abstract Buddha of no fixed mark, but like this one Buddha, or even two Buddhas. These one or two, or three or four Buddhas, the reason that there can be these particular Buddhas is that he adorns himself with no fixed mark. Again, it's all this dialectic of form and emptiness, you could say. The reason you can have particularities in the world is because there's no fixed marks. The reason there can be form is because emptiness. When Nanyue says here that Buddha is no fixed mark, he's describing the mark of the Buddha. Since he's a Buddha of no fixed mark, the seated Buddha is difficult to avoid. That's a great sentence, huh? That's a good one to take into zazen. If you're like, I am so far from being able to sit zazen this period. I'm like way distracted. I'm like, there's no concentration for 1,000 miles. I don't feel settled and at peace at all. This is definitely not zazen. We might think sometimes. I have the thought myself. But since he's a Buddha of no fixed mark, the seated Buddha is difficult to avoid. Because Buddha has no fixed marks. Buddha's sitting has no fixed marks. Like the mark you think it has, like really peaceful, still, and concentrated. It's not like limited to these marks. Therefore, the seated Buddha is difficult to avoid. In other words, you can't get away from Buddha, no matter how crazy your Zazen mind is, it's very difficult to avoid Buddha. Therefore, since it's adorned with this mark of Buddha is no fixed mark, if you're studying seated meditation, you are a seated Buddha. In a non-abiding Dharma, as Nanyue goes on to say, who would grasp or reject something as not the Buddha? Who would grasp or reject it as the Buddha? So there's a line that Dogen, in the original story, that Dogen doesn't like put out in bold. He just weaves it in here, and the line of Nanyue is, in a non-abiding Dharma, there is no grasping or rejecting. Or in the Dharma of no abode, there, how can there be any grasping or rejecting? When not abiding in any, like, any particular marked place, how can there be any grasping or rejecting? That's what we mean, non-abiding, right? The also from the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says the Bodhisattva should give rise to the mind of no abode, or a non-abiding mind. And a mind that doesn't abide in... It's one of the kind of central lines from the Diamond Sutra. Therefore then, Sabuti, the Bodhisattva, the great being, should produce the mind of no abode, or an unsupported thought. A thought, so this is related to non-thinking too, right? The Bodhisattva should produce a thought which doesn't abide in sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or mind objects, or a thought that's nowhere supported by sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or mind objects. And when Workman Lu, who would later become the sixth ancestor, was walking through the marketplace one day, he heard somebody reciting the Diamond Sutra. Apparently that line, Bodhisattvas should give rise to this non-abiding mind, and he just, passing by, heard that and had this spontaneous awakening. It's like, oh wow, my life just completely turned. I gotta go practice Zen now. And he didn't, so he went to find the fifth ancestor and so on. Question or?
Yeah, I'm just confused.
No! Well, Buddha.
I'm confused about, like, non-abiding and how that might be different from non-grasping.
Really, same, I think.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
She heard that one line.
But even in the confusion, the sitting Buddha is difficult to avoid. But so maybe, you know, when Nanyue says, in a non-abiding Dharma, there's no grasping or rejecting, it's just kind of like defining non-abiding, the mind of no abode, means no grasping or rejecting. Yeah. But that's a great Zazen line to bring it, you know, a little like little saying when you're sitting there forgetting what to do. In a non-abiding mind, there's no grasping or rejecting. And in fact, that is the nature of our mind. The mirror does not abide.
What was Dogen's first draft of the essential art? Let's call objects.
When a thought arises, be aware of it. As soon as you're aware of it, it will vanish.
But he said this is the essential. Yeah.
Then as soon as you're aware of it, it will vanish. If you remain for a while forgetting objects, you will naturally become unified. This is the essential art of Zazen.
Okay.
But what is it that is becoming aware of that thought?
Be aware of the thought. Yeah, it sounds like you're splitting the mind into two. Yeah. So you could say it's like some aspect of consciousness is aware of the it's almost like it's like split and is looking at this other aspect of consciousness. Or we could say that what's aware of the thought is actually the mirror. Which is not really consciousness. The mirror is like the non-dual Buddha nature awareness that's just reflecting. So a thought comes before it and the mirror just reflects it. It could be either, yeah.
Some other Zen or Chan master has said, don't fear the arising of thought, only fear being slow to become aware of it.
So thoughts arising are just thoughts arising and vanishing, and but when we're not aware, we just get caught up in them. They pull us into the stream of the narrative of this storyline of thoughts, and then we're not aware that we're being carried in this narrative stream. But as soon as you're aware of it, I think that's what he means. You're, oh wait, I'm being like carried away in the stream at some other time and place. And then if we're really like, oh yeah, that's what's happening, but I'm just right here now, then it vanishes. Some people might say, well, can you be mindful of the storyline? Can you be aware of the story and just continue the story, knowing partially that you're in the present? And I think to some extent we can, but very difficult. Like, I wouldn't recommend it as a meditation object, you know. Like this thought stream about what we're going to do tomorrow, like we'll be really concentrated on this as our meditation. Maybe in the end, maybe it is possible, but as a practice, I think it's not so helpful.
The analogy that kind of excites me because I've done some acting is the whole thing of being in a play, fully being in the play, being a master actor means you really are in the play, but you also know that it's a play.
Yeah.
You know, the only mystery, the only craziness is why the play? But that's not important to the actor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like my teacher often, people will ask, well, why are beings deluded? And he basically, any questions, he'll say, I actually don't answer why questions. Because they don't really go anywhere. They're very interesting, but actually why is like, it's almost like a distraction. How is a good question, or what? But why, it's like, no, we're very curious, but we don't really need to know why we're in the play. Just how do we play it out?
Beautifully.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great metaphor, I think. It's like Sashin is like that, right? It's just a play. But like, let's do it really wholeheartedly, like serving Orioki and stuff. Let's make a medieval Japanese monastery just so. Just get totally into it. And you could say, well, why? But don't ask that.
Well,
there's no answer to that. Didn't we just do it?
You could say why, because it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's art.
It's beauty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which has something.
Yeah.
Harmony. Something that warms something about it.
To be honest, I think that's how I see a lot of our like kind of ritual forms and like Orioki and stuff. It really is just like art or like dance, and it's just a beautiful expression, and we have particular ways of doing it, and it's, you know, we say part of the art is that, like, well, this is this really ancient way that we're going to just keep maintaining it because there's something beautiful just about that in itself. You could also say it's beautiful to, like, change it all around and make a new version. So we do some of that too. But if we start to say, we have to do it this way because, like, Dogen said so or something, then we've lost maybe the play quality. Part of the play is, like, when you're in the... Probably, I haven't been an actor like that, but I would guess that, like, you have to get to really act well, you have to really, like, almost believe it, like, really, like, pretend as if it's really serious.
Yeah.
Like, you can't just say, oh, it's just a play, so it doesn't matter. I missed my lines, but it's just a play. It's like, no, I'm really going to... I have to get this line perfectly.
Yeah. Well, there's no fixed mark in this Buddha. It's like that emptiness, concept of emptiness, of if there's no essential, if there's no essence, if there's no core that you can say that's it,
yeah.
If it's not fixed, you're already more intimate, or you're already intimate with it. It's nothing, you're not going to be bumping up against it, you're already going to be joining it. If there's no fixed essence here, if there's no fixed essence there, if essence...
Here an essence, there an essence, everywhere an essence, essence.
If essences are a little bit alike in their non-being, already you're intimate.
Yeah, we could even say emptiness, you know, coursing in emptiness is the realm of total intimacy. It's where everything is totally flexible and unfixed, and yet is it's not nothingness. Emptiness is, there's appearance of play-like appearance of everything happening. But it's very intimate also because it's like the sense of separateness and non-intimacy goes along with fixed mark. Or it seems like when things are discrete, they're separate. And in emptiness and intimacy, there's not any true separation. Everything is like interdependently manifesting. Yeah. Buddha is like that. No fixed mark.
I'm redundant, but I was just reading the translation of the Heart Sutra, and the Japanese translator, or he was kind of going over more talking about it. Well, he said, which had never occurred to me, that the reason they use all these negatives in the sutras and double negatives is because of that tendency of ours to want to hold some preconceived notion of what something is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but if you keep approaching it from, well, it's not this and it's not this, and then you're left with this question of, well, what is it? So that leaves us kind of with this open stillness of,
I won't say, I won't say.
But what is it? What?
Yeah, what is it? What is it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. The via negativa is the mode of the Prajnaparamita. All these hundreds, thousands of volumes of sutras never say, this is what it is. But they say a lot of what it's not, which is basically anything we can think of. It's not this, not this. And then there's some little play on that, like, well, all phenomena do actually have this one characteristic. They really do have this one characteristic. And it's no characteristic. Or emptiness. They're marked by emptiness. Yeah, the negative. It's because sitting meditation has dropped off all grasping and rejecting that it is a seated Buddha. I think that's another really great summary line, very straightforward definition of Zazen, you could say. Dogen's understanding of Zazen sums up the whole thing. And again, it's because Zazen has dropped off all grasping and rejecting that it's sitting Buddha. So you could say, if all this seems very confusing, well, what is the Zazen he's talking about anyway? In the end, it's actually just dropping off all grasping and rejecting and all the gross manifestations and the very subtle ones. And that's, you know, in that way we could say that practice is transmitted from Shakyamuni Buddha, because that's the very first teaching, right, that we chant sitting in motion, the wheel of Dharma. The Buddha says, in the end, in summary, what is suffering? It's grasping body and mind, the five aggregates we call body and mind. So that's dis-ease, that's discontent, that's suffering. What is nirvana? What's the cessation of suffering? The end of suffering is no more grasping or rejecting. And Dogen likes to say drop off. Just let go. Drop off means let go of all grasping and rejecting. That's what Zazen is. Yes?
Is grasping one of the 12 links of dependent origination?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it the one after feeling?
It's after craving. So first there's
contact, feeling, craving.
Contact of mind and object. We have that, therefore we have an experience. Every experience immediately comes with a feeling of it's a little pleasant, or it's a little unpleasant, or it's way pleasant or way unpleasant. But a feeling is like so universal. I mean, it's an extra link there, but as soon as there's a sensory or mental contact, we have feeling. Pleasant or unpleasant is like, this is another meditation you can do in Zazen, is like, what's the feel? It's a contemplation of feeling. It's the second foundation of mindfulness. Is it pleasant or unpleasant? And then you can just see if you can stop at the feeling. This is just unpleasant. My knee hurts. Unpleasant. And then the next, dependent on the 12 links you're talking about, is dependent on feeling. Craving arises, or the desire or wish to either extend the pleasant feeling or eliminate the unpleasant one. And that's a good place to like break the chain. It's like, it's unpleasant, but I don't wish it to be pleasant. Or it's pleasant and I don't wish it to continue. We almost never wish for it to be unpleasant. And I wouldn't recommend that either. It's just like, you just stop with the feeling. I think this is another way of looking at Zazen. You know, just mindfulness of body and feeling. It's just pleasant or unpleasant. And then, but you could say, it, because its chain keeps going along, often, what happens is, dependent on feeling, some wish, again, a little or a lot, for it to be like a little bit different feeling. Usually, better. And then that's still not the definition of suffering yet. But Buddha does say craving is the origin of suffering. And then dependent on craving, grasping arises. It's like a solidification. And grasping is the definition of suffering.
So what is grasping? Just more intense craving? Like I've just got to have this, or I'm going to do whatever it takes to get this?
That's one way it's sometimes talked about. Yeah, more intensified,
like you're actually, in a sense, going for it.
Going for it. Yeah, you're committed, exactly. Like, you know, like, I want this book. I really want this book. And then grasping is like, almost, you could say physically, we actually reach out and get a hold of it. But really, mostly we're talking about mind grasping. Like, I'm really, I think there's possible to break the chain there, too. And so this would maybe be like, maybe a very hard place to break the chain, but like maybe possible, like I really want this feeling to stop. I'm watching very carefully how the mind's working here. I'm not actually grasping, I'm not into like, and I'm totally obsessed and committed to stopping this unpleasant feeling. It's more like, I really would appreciate it stopping now, and that's, but I'm not going beyond that. Maybe one could practice right at that point, and it wouldn't be, technically speaking, suffering. But as soon as we're like, and I gotta do something now, now we're like, we're not content. So it's a little funny maybe to say, we're really wishing for something to be different, and it's contentment is the opposite of discontent or suffering. Maybe, especially in a kind of Zen-like way, maybe possible to like really want something and actually just be so present with this wanting and not getting into the next step that actually there's some contentment underneath. It's like, yeah, this is what it's like to be a person who really wants something, and it's okay. I'm actually okay with this. But I think that next step, like, and I'm gonna get it now. Now we're like caught. And then the next chain in the next link in the chain is becoming, and which is a kind of a strange one, but Ajahn Amaro defines this in a way that has stuck with me, that he says that becoming link in the chain, after grasp, dependent on grasping this becoming, he defines it as the thrill of getting what you want. It's like, I really want the book, and I'm gonna get it, and I got it, and like, I got it! Yes! Like, I've become the person who got what I wanted. It's like, really solidified now. The thrill of getting what we want. Like, is that so bad? Well, it's kind of like, keeps this whole chain going.
The karma is completed.
Yeah, the karma is completed. Yeah, I think so. And depending on becoming, there's a birth. Is it like kind of a solidification of becoming? It means like we're born as the new person who got what we want. And depending on birth is death. And the whole thing keeps going. But grasping in the is kind of like, my understanding is grasping is not so much the cause of suffering, but actually the definition of suffering. If you look carefully, like the Four Noble Truths, craving or this strong wish is the origin of suffering, but suffering is defined in that first sutra as grasping. So, and in 12-fold chain to craving, dependent on craving, there's grasping. And you could say that's what we could call that suffering. Was there? Yes.
Just from my Theravada days, so greed, hatred, and delusion are the three. It's wanting, rejecting,
grasping and rejecting.
Yeah. So those are the three. I know that one of the Sayadaws, one of the Us, read a book by him, so that would have been Thai or Cambodian master. And so the practice was about actually noticing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Grasping. You notice your mind wanting to go for something. You notice you're not wanting to, like, oh God, I really don't want that. I don't want that. I don't want that. And then the delusion would be more like just the kind of spacing out or being totally misperceiving.
You could also say delusion is like the root of the other two. It's like we're confused. We think that things have fixed marks, and that's the basic delusion. We don't see the emptiness of things.
Right, and so it's all the activity of the mind.
Yeah.
It's kind of looking at the activity of the mind. Mm-hmm. This is...
As soon as we see that the book has a fixed mark, then it's going to be, we're going to probably want to grasp or reject it. Or we might not want to. We might just say, oh, it's just a book. But it really is a book. But it's basically the setup is like, if things have fixed marks, where that's what makes them possible to think that we can grasp or reject them. So even if we're not grasping or rejecting, as soon as there's fixed marks, everything is very graspable, and we're just sitting ducks waiting for the next fixed object to grasp. So that's why people might wonder why, you know, why all this emphasis on emptiness in Buddhism and Zen, and like, what about just, let's just deal with suffering directly, where you could say, let's go into the root, like, that's the, if we really understand emptiness, the proposition is, it's impossible to grasp anything or reject anything at the time of actually seeing, this is really not a book, then you actually can't really grasp it or reject it. It appears, though. But if we really see it just as a mere appearance, it's not worth grasping a mere appearance. Then we can just dance with it. Then it's like in a play. We can read the play book. But,
the opposite of emptiness would be abundance. What if everything was available and there was no problem, no need to grasp?
Well, sometimes people like to translate emptiness as like fullness or abundance, or like, because in a way it has that, there's that implication. If everything is empty of fixed marks, then there's this, everything is this one big abundant display of intimacy. It's like that. And I think that's true. Emptiness and abundance are not so different. But just like Jane said, the reason why the negative is taught emptiness instead of fullness is because if you say something positive like all dharmas are marked by abundance and fullness, then it's easier to get a hold of that. So this always saying, you know, it seems so negative, but actually it's just good medicine for people who are like all of us, who so easily can grasp onto things. To say all dharmas are empty is a little bit like, oh, can't get a hold of that. If we say all dharmas are abundantly filled with interpenetrating suchness, then we're like, ah! So all this talk about grasping upadana, and that greed, hate, and delusion. Greed is like grasping, hate or anger is like rejecting. It's these two different directions, basically the same energy in two different directions. One's more of, one's less of, away, towards, and they're both based on the delusion that that something's wrong right here in the middle. We have to go this way or away or away. So we talk a lot about acceptance too. It's like just being with what's happening is not grasping or rejecting. So again, this sentence, it's because Zazen has dropped off all grasping and rejecting that it is sitting Buddha. It's one of like the simplest sentences in the whole essay. Hard to practice, but very like all-inclusive practice. I mean, when you're sitting and wondering what to do and you feel like you're not content, just remember, and you want to say, I want to really practice Zazen now. Okay, Zazen is dropping off, letting go of all that movement towards and away. So painful, this body sitting here, so painful, these thoughts. Okay, just like, don't move, don't do anything. Just completely settle into it. Drop off. And when Dogen says drop off body and mind, I think what he actually means is drop off grasping and rejecting body and mind. To the very bottom. It's not like your physical body literally like disappears or something, but there's no grasping or rejecting the body, then the body just sits. Panyue continues, if you're studying sitting Buddha, this is killing Buddha. This means that when we investigate further the notion of sitting Buddha, we find that it has the virtue of killing Buddha. Probably everyone's heard of in Zen, Linji, great ancestor Linji said, you know, when you meet, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. If you meet an ancestor, kill him. Meaning, like, drop off grasping and rejecting your idea of Buddha or ancestor. Just a startling way to say it that kind of like has a nice shock factor. But that's all it means. And it's a little bit like, I mean, Linji was a kind of, you know, a rough energetic type, so it, you know, we might say that's a little too strong. How about just, if you meet the Buddha, let go of Buddha. Kill is a little bit like Manjushri's sword. You know, cut through your idea of Buddha right now. But sometimes we need direct. I think this totally depends on the person and the occasion. Sometimes we need the very gentle approach. Like, I'm already really worked up. I'm really like, I don't feel so good about myself and what's happening here and all of it. And so we shouldn't get into killing Buddha. I think at this point we shouldn't. That's not the right meditation. The meditation there is just totally relax into this open spaciousness that's surrounding our whole experience with total, like, loving kindness and warmth surrounding. Like, that's the appropriate time, the appropriate meditation for such a mind. If we're feeling like, I already feel like really comfy here and like actually and really kind of like sleepy, and I, this one daydream I keep running through like every period, I love it. I'm like, let's do it again. Yeah, here's my fantasy. It goes like this. Let's do it. Maybe I'm going to do it every period of Sesshin, just to see if I can sustain it. It's so pleasant. I already feel like this warm, cozy feeling. And I think that, and because Buddha is everything, this is Buddha, right? This is sitting Buddha. So like, those people struggling in Sesshin, they could be having a fantasy like me to be this kind of Buddha. This is the time to bring out the sword. All right. Yeah, cut through that whole scenario. Killing Buddha. In Vajrayana Buddhism, there's wrathful deities. That's my understanding there. That they have peaceful and wrathful Buddhas and Bodhisattvas for different inclinations and at different times of practice. And I think it's particularly around kind of like the sort of lazy, kind of like dull, apathetic mind needs the really like blood dripping fangs, like thousand eyes and all these weapons and all the hands, like bring that one out. Nah, I don't need that one, you know, after lunch. That period of zazen after lunch. Yeah. So this means that when we investigate further the notion of sitting Buddha, we find it has the virtue of killing Buddha. At the very moment that we are sitting Buddha, we are killing Buddha. Okay. Sitting Buddha is dropping off all grasping and rejecting. This is killing Buddha. Indeed, when we pursue it, we find that the 32 marks and the 80 signs and the radiance of killing Buddha are always a seated Buddha. So these, you know, the Buddha is not, cannot be known by these 32 marks. But again, these 32 marks, like long earlobes, are a sitting Buddha. They're the expression of a sitting Buddha. Where it's always back and forth. It's all empty, and yet there's long earlobes in this world. Although the word kill here is identical with that used by ordinary people, its meaning is not the same. Moreover, we must investigate in what form it is that a seated Buddha is killing Buddha. So always investigate how this is so. Taking up the fact that it is itself a virtue of the Buddha to kill Buddha, we should study whether we are killers or not. Katagiri Roshi, in Each Moment is the Universe, has a chapter on this fascicle, this section that we're reading, just a little section that we're reading now. And his commentary, which is often like, it has almost nothing to do with the fascicle. It's just he uses it as like a launching pad. But in this section about Dogen's whole commentary on killing Buddha, and then Katagiri Roshi says, well, Zen masters in China talked about killing Buddha very often. It's one of their favorite terms. It means total actualization and manifestation with no gap, no space to let something extra get in. That's what killing means. Interesting, huh? If you completely jump into an athletic game, you are melted into the game. If you sit zazen, you're melted into zazen. When no solid form of a person, time, and space all come together and work together, you create a beautiful form. That's a little bit like what Patrick was saying. Right? When there's no solid form of person, time, and space, when this is all working together, it's this beautiful intimacy. Form, at that time you forget yourself and create your own life. That's called creativity. So you can show creativity, but you don't know what it is. So provisionally we say it's a miracle. But it's not really a miracle. It's something alive. When you manifest creativity from moment to moment, it's called killing Buddha. An interesting commentary on killing Buddha is manifesting creativity. This is wonderful, but Dogen says we have to go beyond this because the virtue of the killing Buddha can be discovered.
Can be discovered?
Can be. So how does he translate? He translates that first sentence. He says, Nanyue says, if you become a sitting Buddha, it is a killing Buddha. Then he said, Dogen says, eventually if you study and penetrate further sitting Buddha, the virtue of the killing Buddha can be discovered. Ar says, when we investigate further the notion of seated Buddha, we find that it has the virtue of killing Buddha. And,
translation.
Yeah.
That last line says, taking up the fact that killing Buddha is a virtue of the Buddha, we should study whether or not we are killing people or not killing people. Your translation was killers, but when I read this, I thought, we are killing people, but maybe killing people is like killers.
Interesting.
Well, we are killing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought.
Oh. That's interesting. Is that the first place it's been different from what I read?
No.
Oh. It's been different.
Oh, okay. Because they're both Karl Bielfeld.
We're not even on the same page.
Oh.
This is.
So this is.
Close, though. It's close.
The one I'm reading is from Karl Bierfeld's book, which is an excellent book and has extensive commentary on all these stories we're talking about in his own, you know, ways that nothing's so different from what we've talked about, really. But the book's called Dogen's Manuals of Zen Meditation. And it's like, it's mostly about the Fukan Zazengi that we chanted this morning, but also about Zazen Shin. And then on the, online, on the Soto Zen Text Project, they're putting up all these fascicles. So they have, that printout is from the online version, which is more recent. So it looks like Carl went through and changed some things. By the way, Carl Bielefeld was a student of Suzuki Roshi. Yeah, he practiced with him in the early days of Zen Center and felt like he had very scholarly tendencies. He really liked studying, and he learned Chinese and Japanese, but he was trying to practice at Tassajara, and he asked Suzuki Roshi, he's like, I'm really into this like studying Dharma thing, but I feel like there's not so much time to do that at Tassajara, and I know you emphasize just sitting a lot and practice periods and stuff. And so I feel kind of torn, because I feel like maybe you think it would be better for me to just live in the monastery here. And Suzuki Roshi said to him, no, if you have that inclination, you go be a scholar, be a Zen scholar. We need that, really. So here's the fruits. He wrote this book. He's a teacher at Stanford, right? Of Buddhist studies chair. And I think for studying Dogen in like university kind of format, like scholastic study of Dogen, in the whole U.S., that would be the place to go, Stanford, with Karl Bielefeld. There's other Dogen scholars, but he's like, it's a whole Dogen department.
Wow.
At Stanford, as I understand it. Yeah. Anyway, this section is we should investigate what form the sitting Buddha that is killing Buddha has, holding up the fact that a virtue of Buddha is killing Buddha. We should investigate whether we have killed our human self or have not yet killed our human self. That's a stretch. It actually, so the Chinese says, killing person, not killing person. So you could read it as, it doesn't actually say self. So you could see it as a killing person, or killing persons. I think you could read it either way. So Kaz says, investigate the fact that the function of Buddha is itself killing Buddha, and study killing and not killing a true person. The true, I don't know about where that true, the true is not really in there, but that's, And so Nishijima's translation says, taking up the fact that among the virtues of Buddha, killing Buddha is already present, we should learn and practice whether we ourselves are killing a person or not yet killing a person. Are killing a person instead of a killing person. But I think whether we're talking about us or the people, this person or those people, same practice, right? Kill them all. Suicide and homicide, both.
I think session.
Time for a break.
Kill.
Well,
to take the life that we're feeding, we're adding on to things, this extra life, and like we just like drop off that extra life that we're adding in, sort of like killing.
Yeah, not
the aversion. Yeah. It's a dangerous word, but I think it's like Linji coined that phrase for shock value. Yes.
Do we get a word from the Zumoki?
Oh, would you like?
Yes.
Okay. This is a story about this story. This is Dogen's kind of like informal conversations. You can see all through Dogen's different writings. He likes this story. And as I've said before, I really like this story about polishing the tile because it's like it's very straightforward zazen instruction. It's really about zazen, right? The approach to how we practice meditation. On one occasion, someone asked, "How do you feel about the following view, Dogen?" Sometimes people would ask, like, this is informal, right? Upon hearing that one's own self is the Buddha Dharma and that it's futile to seek anything outside of oneself, a student were to believe this deeply, give up practice and studying, and spend his whole life doing good and bad according to his nature. Good question, huh? This is a little bit like, is staying at home asleep the same as coming to the Zendo? It's the same as like, well, everything's Buddha Dharma, so the precepts are and no precepts are all the same. This is like a common kind of like Zen sickness or like, you know, emptiness sickness, falling into a one-sided view of nothing matters, right? People were asking this in Dogen's time, especially about the seeking part. I think that's what's interesting. We're not seeking Buddha. So if we're not seeking, then it's just like, why practice? Dogen said, in this view, the person's words and reality are contradictory. Giving up practice and abandoning study because of the futility of seeking anything outwardly sounds as though something's being sought after by the act of giving it up. This is not non-seeking. I thought that's such a great answer. Yeah? And very straightforward. Nice thing about this Zui Monkey is Dogen's just straightforward. He's not messing with all these weird language plays. So, yeah, and then you're just like, well, it's a hidden underlying seeking that like, you know, well, I'm just lying in bed, I'm just like really relaxed here, and like, I don't want to seek Buddha, so like, why go over and sit on that painful cushion again? That's seeking Buddha. But of course, in that case, it's very quite obvious, right? There is this seeking to stay in bed, right? Seeking to like stay so comfortable like this. But I'm not seeking anything. So this is seeking something by giving up. I think that would be like, we could test ourselves, because there really might be a time when we do stay in bed and don't go to the Zendo, which really isn't seeking. So I think that's the thing, is to just check out our own mind. Am I trying to get something for myself? And what's the best way to give up myself and give myself to all beings? Sometimes it's to stay in bed. I got to sleep really late last night, and to help beings all day today, I need a good night's sleep. Acceptance machine. Then we have to help beings by coming.
But I remember our conversation a few weeks ago about free will. So I get all confused and thrown by this conversation. I mean, it's like, do we have will to stay in bed or not stay in bed?
Yes.
We don't get into that now.
It does sound like that in the original question, right? Spend one's whole life doing good and bad according to his nature.
Well,
it's kind of like, oh, there's no free will, so just whatever the conditions give rise to. Yeah, it's a little bit like, again, my understanding of that would be like, and I think I tried to answer that in this talk that's in the newsletter, where it's like, but maybe not so fully. It's like if we use this as an excuse, there's no free will, so I just do whatever I want. That's like what Dogen would say. That's still, there's some seeking in there. Or that's actually asserting a kind of hidden will. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, no free will, so I'll just do this. It's not my will, it's just what's happening. I think there's this hidden underlying free will. We think that there's a self that's still doing that, and we're using this great no free will teaching as an excuse to just like indulge ourself. Like that? I think it's similar to this principle of Dogen. It's like giving up, you know, controlling yourself with your free will is actually, sounds like something is still being controlled by your will. There's a way to read this in terms of free will. This is not non-seeking, or not no free will. So Dogen goes on, just realize that practice and study themselves are Buddha Dharma. Without seeking anything, refrain from engaging in worldly affairs or evil things, even if you have the mind to do so. So kind of like, follow the precepts. Don't harm others, but without seeking anything. Do not think of or hate the boredom of the practice of the way. It's a good one for Sashin. This is so boring. How many periods of zazen has this been? So don't hate the boredom of zazen practice, long sitting. Just practice wholeheartedly. Practice without even seeking after the completion of the way or the attainment of the result. This attitude is in accordance with the principle of non-seeking. So, just practice wholeheartedly but without seeking. That's always Dogen's bottom line. You could say, why? Why do that instead of not? That's what we don't answer. Those kinds of questions. Just practice wholeheartedly. Through Nanyue's polishing a tile to make a mirror, he was admonishing Matsu's seeking to become a Buddha. Still, he did not restrain Matsu from sitting zazen. Which some people interpret that. I heard that actually Alan Watts, a great bringer of Dharma to America in the early days, knew all these Zen stories, and he didn't have a practice himself, and when people would ask him, like, well, you're so into Zen, like, why don't you actually sit zazen and, like, do a practice period or something? He would say, well, he would quote this story and be like, zazen's not a matter of sitting or lying down. It's like, has no fixed mark, you know. You don't make Buddha by, like, polishing a tile. So Dogen's clarifying this to say that, like, he's admonishing Matsu's seeking to become some other Buddha in the future. But he didn't stop Matsu from sitting. He didn't say, so why don't you just stop all this zazen that you're doing? He probably encouraged it, or probably sat down with him. That's, I think, the key line here. Still, he said don't seek, but he didn't stop him from sitting zazen. Sitting itself is the practice of the Buddha. Sitting itself is non-doing. It is nothing but the true form of the true self. Apart from sitting, there's nothing to seek as Buddha Dharma. Shikan Taza. Just wholehearted sitting for no reason at all. Period after period. Like a fool, like an idiot. If someone asks why, I don't know. Would you like to join me?
Joseph Campbell called it the hero's journey.
Mm. The heroic diligence to not come up with a reason.
Yeah.
Only. My teacher Tongan Roshi in Japan, who would like to say, shikan taza. Also, would like to say, Ichitante, ichitante, ichitante. Only this doing. Only one doing. This ichitante is like, I don't know if it comes from Dogen or if he made up the expression, but like, it means like, only one complete expression. Or in English, he would say, only doing, just doing. So whether it's sitting or going to the toilet or serving a meal or whatever, only. Justice. He only had maybe like 10 words in English that he just... There was maybe half the people of this temple were English speakers, but it was enough English for us. only. Sometimes, you know, in Sesshin, long Dharma talks in Japanese, right? Like, don't understand a word of it. It's just like, oh, come on. Japanese people probably loved it. And it was like, the form there was, for the Dharma talks, was you're sitting, period of Zazen before the talk, you're sitting there facing the wall, and then like about 40 minutes, and then he comes in to give the talk, and you still just keep facing the wall, and would chant the Ehe Koso Hotsuganmon very, very slowly. And then he's like sitting in the center, and then he just starts giving the talk. But the idea, I think, is that like you're receiving the talk in Zazen. So everyone's facing the wall. Very strange, I think, for a Dharma talk. I don't know if other places do that or not. So you can't see him. I think there's some virtue in the intimacy of seeing and hearing. And then he talks for like an hour or two. And you're still after this, you're still just sitting there, and there's no kinyan or anything, right? And it's all like you don't understand a word of it. But then occasionally you're sitting there just not dropping off, grasping and rejecting. and Japanese, and then all of a sudden, like in the middle of the stream of Japanese, he'll say, only this one doing, here, now, only. And you wake up and you're like, yes, I remember the practice. And he goes back into Japanese. Later in the evening, a translator would very kindly, like, give the whole talk in English to the English speakers. And my job was to ring the Boncho bell. Boncho bell is this huge temple bell that's, you know, rings through the whole town. Green Gulch has one, yeah. The big log in a bell tower. And so there it would be like the tradition is first thing in the morning, like on the way to morning Zazen, someone rings it. Then and they open the temple gates for the day. And then in the evening they ring it again and close the temple gates. And then there's like a midday Boncho. And that was my job, was the midday Boncho player. You chant the Enmejuku Kanengyo with every ring, too. At the top of your lungs. Kanzeo Namu! So that you can hear it all there. And at the end of the verse, dong! And so, I was very grateful for my job because this 11:30, whatever it was, Boncho always seemed to fall during that Dharma talk. In Sesshin. If it wasn't Sesshin, it would be kind of like on your free time and you'd have to go put on your robes to go ring the bell, you know. But during Sesshin, it was like, everyone gets to keep sitting, but I have to get up. and get to move. And you go out and you do the whole Bonzo thing and you come back in and he's still talking. Sit back down again and keep going, if it was a long one. And but the other nice thing about being that Bonzo player, besides getting to move, was you got to see the Roshi giving the talk. No one else got to see him, because you got to get up and walk by him on your way out. And it was quite something to like watch him. He was like this fireball of energy. He'd have like a podium thing like this with a book or something on it. And he'd just be kind of speaking spontaneously. But in his kind of, it's an old guy, right? But in his kind of intensity, he'd be like gripping the podium like this. And his eyes would almost always be closed like the whole time. And he'd be talking like this. only this wondering, you know.
Preaching.
What?
Preaching.
Preaching, yeah, like
preacher.
Like just like he was just like on fire with Dharma. It felt like just this love of like practice and Dharma and just like and sashini, you know, or just like in it. Not so relaxed, right? More just like, I think there's a deep inner relaxation, but just like expression of like intense energy. May all beings enjoy polishing their tile. The big, big mirror shining in the background. May the merit and virtue of our practice support and sustain all beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.